Planets Eaten by Stars, and One Astronaut's Guide to Infinite Possibilities. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. We've heard of asteroids smashing into planets and black holes that consume everything in their path, but what about a hungry star? In our own galaxy, one planet got too close to its own star before it was gobbled up. We'll speak with Ryan Lowe and Colette Salick, co-authors on a new research paper that studied this stellar swallowing. Then, One Astronaut is bringing his off-worldly experiences back down to Earth. Veteran NASA astronaut Dr. Bernard Harris is trying to inspire others to reach for the stars in his new book, Embracing Infinite Possibilities, Letting Go of Fear to Find Your Highest Potential. We'll speak with Dr. Harris about the book and his journey to space. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? So we know black holes exist in our universe, consuming anything in their path and getting bigger and bigger as they swallow whatever is nearby. But there are other things that engulf stellar stuff like asteroids, rocky surfaces, or even planets. That's a star in our own galaxy. With help from NASA's James Webb Space Telescope, a new paper suggests a planet crept towards its own star before being swallowed whole. So with this new research, are stars more like black holes? And could Earth's orbit slowly creep towards our own sun before getting gobbled by it? We're here to answer those questions and talk about this cosmic phenomenon are co-authors of that study, Ryan Lowe and Colette Salick. Ryan is an assistant astronomer at NSF's NOR lab, and Colette is an associate professor of astronomy on the Maria Mitchell Chair at Vassar College. Ryan, Colette, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks.
So you both are lead authors on this study that essentially performs an autopsy of this planet. Before we get into the details, Ryan, can you tell me what planet we're talking about, what star we're talking about, where about in the galaxy is this?
It's located about, 10,000 light years away from us. Can't give you the exact coordinate, but it's kind of like looking into towards kind of the center of where a galaxy is. So it's not in the opposite direction. This is like, maybe it was a Jupiter mass planet and a star that was slightly redder and fainter than our sun that met this kind of final fate of it being swallowed up or falling into the star.
Colette, this final fate of falling into a star, we've heard about black holes swallowing up everything in its path, but this is a star essentially swallowing up a planet. Is this something that we know happens quite often, and should I be terrified of this?
So it is something that we hypothesized happened. I don't think we've seen it before. And the reason is that, you know, if a planet gets close enough to a star, then they both experience tidal forces. And that's the same thing that happens with black holes and whatever they're eating. So we don't have to worry in our solar system because we don't actually have any planets that are close enough to the sun that they're really experiencing those tidal forces.
Okay, so we're okay here. We don't have to worry about that.
Yes, we're good.
Fantastic. Ryan, you know, this observation you all made, it's a little bit different than what you had assumed would happen if these kind of tidal forces interacted, right? What was the conventional wisdom as to what happens when this occurs, and what's different about what you observed?
Well, actually, what we thought, like the picture that we had in mind of what happened here with this planetary engulfment event was that the star has evolved and it's becoming this red giant and that it swallowed up this planet. So nothing really to do with tidal forces before, just stellar evolution that's triggering this consumption of the planet. And that's what kind of was totally revised with our JWST observations, where we saw that this is not likely the case here. That's not the mechanism that triggered this planetary engulfment. That was what our data pointed out, and that we weren't essentially like looking to disprove that hypothesis. It's just something that comes with the sensitivity that we get with this wonderful new telescope facility with JWST.
Colette, is this a common occurrence in the cosmos, or is this kind of a very rare occasion that you were able to capture with these observations?
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, it probably happens somewhat often, but not often enough that we're going to see it a lot. And so that's what was pretty amazing about the initial discovery, was just seeing this actually happen. And Ryan can tell you more about just how difficult that is, but you have to really just stare at the sky, just stare at stars in the sky over and over and over again until you just happen to catch this happening.
There are like theoretical and also observationally based predictions that there should be like one of these or several of these to maybe a little less than that per year. So that's based on the current estimates that we have. But there's also limitations on why exactly that's we're having trouble detecting these. As Colette said, you have to really stare at the sky to build up the sensitivity and to detect these things. These are transient events, so things varying in the sky. And we'll soon have things that are able to look at into much deeper sensitivities and fainter brightnesses, which this thing was. It was pretty faint, relatively. So that's one thing that will get cleared up pretty soon, how uncovering exactly how many of these there are and following up more of them to build up a nice population of these to learn more about what goes on.
You said you have to just stare at one particular area for a very long time. How long was this observation made? What was the time frame of this?
Oh, yeah. That's okay. So maybe that's a little bit of a misnomer. It's more like you're making like movies of the sky. So there's this facility called the Zuki Transient Facility, where it's just taking images of essentially all of the observable sky. This is based in Palomar in California. And it was through that where it was found. It was also found through the NEOWISE infrared telescope, which also scans the sky, except that's looking for near-Earth asteroids, not necessarily transient events. But that data are particularly useful for finding these things, especially at infrared wavelengths. So it's maybe taking like 60-second snapshots, but the key is that it revisits it like every couple nights. So you can find these things that are changing very quickly in the sky. And also, like, yeah, you want to make sure you can go deep enough to detect the fainter objects.
Now I'm fascinated by how you found this then. So you're looking at these time-lapse images of the night sky over time. Were you looking for this particular event, or did you see something in these images that was, hey, that's a little wild. Let's take a look and see what actually caused that.
We're wandering a little bit more into the discovery of this. And that was done by another paper by Keish Leday. He's a new assistant professor at Columbia University. And he published the first like discovery paper of this. I was on that paper as well as a co-author, and he's also on this paper that we followed up with JWST. But basically, like what happened there is it wasn't really classified as anything particularly interesting, because you see lots of things that brighten up and then fade away over time. So it was kind of, it just looked like a nova or some other type of traditional type of variability or astrophysical explosion. It was because of the combination with infrared data from NEOWISE that you can kind of put that picture together that, okay, wait, there's something more interesting going on here than just like a run-of-the-mill, like, you know, stellar explosion. There's a little more interesting physics going on here. That's kind of the fun part of doing time domain astronomy. There's a lot of stuff that's like, what is this thing? In the follow-up paper, we knew what we were looking at. We just didn't know exactly what the what we're going to find.
Colette, I'm looking at kind of an artist concept of this happening, and we're seeing the planet kind of its orbit get smaller and smaller, and then get sucked and swallowed into the star, and then this poof. This cloud. What do we know about that whole process? What happens at the end of this?
Oof. What I would say, I don't know that we know a ton. So that's what's unique about this is we're observing it for the first time. We do have some theoretical ideas about what might happen, but I don't know that we knew we were going to see this exact set of features, which is kind of like a larger cool cloud and then this very hot disk. And so that's actually why I got pulled into this team, is because there's this very small disk of hot material that resembles actually a planet forming region. So it's almost like the reverse. It's like you formed the planet and now it's at the end of its life, and then it's some of its material is ending up in a disk shape again.
Yeah, that disk is pretty fascinating. Are we looking at the circle of life here, swallowed by a star, and then the star ejects this material, which then becomes another planet again?
I mean, that is the circle of life in the interstellar medium. I mean, that is how stars replenish the interstellar medium, and then eventually they form new planets. I don't think we believe that in these particular disks around the dying star, we don't expect new planets to form.
Gotcha. Fascinating. I guess I want to focus on, you know, you mentioned this is something like 10,000, 12,000 light years away from Earth. It's very faint in the sky. What role did JWST play in making this observation? Would you have been able to do this without that telescope?
Yeah, absolutely not. We definitely needed the capabilities of JWST to do this autopsy, to do this, like investigate the aftermath of this planetary engulfment event. And the reason for that is we need the sensitivity in the infrared wavelengths where all this information is at that's coming from the system. We need the sensitivity of something in space because from the ground, it's very difficult to do this type of infrared astronomy. The clouds and the water vapor in the atmosphere of the Earth like will obstruct and interfere with infrared emission at these wavelengths. So we needed that, and we needed something really big too. We needed like a 6-meter telescope like JWST to get the actual like precision that we can actually distinguish this event from anything else that's going on in the background that might contaminate the signal from that particular source. Because the galactic plane, there's a lot of stuff going on. If we're looking kind of into the plane of our galaxy, you're seeing all the stuff that's like along that line of sight. So it's a very crowded region of the sky to look at. So we had the perfect capabilities with JWST to get this information. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been able to do this. It would have been just totally impossible.
Colette, I'm always fascinated by the ability of JWST, especially in exoplanet research, learning so much about exoplanets because JWST. I mean, is this just another example of the things that we are able to see outside of our own solar system because of this incredible spacecraft?
Oh yeah, definitely. And just to elaborate a little on what Ryan said, you know, when you're looking at planetary things, you're looking at things that are in Earth's atmosphere. So you're looking at molecules that we have like water or carbon monoxide in this case. And so it's particularly difficult to look at planetary things through a planetary atmosphere because our own atmosphere is blocking the light that we would want to be seeing.
And finally, to the both of you, what comes next? What questions still remain, and what do you both hope to observe when it comes to this death plunge that you've observed?
Well, I would say I think it'd be really cool to see more of these. I think that's what I would love to know is, you know, do they all look the same? Do they all have these same features? I don't know what you think, Ryan.
Yeah, 100%. That would be my response. Like, we want to find more of these. Like, this is like just one. And with the sample size of one, you can't really make too strong inferences from that. So building up the population, following up more of these with JWST, I think will be really exciting. And what's also really exciting is like the new facilities coming out that will be perfect for finding more of these events, like the Vera C. Rubin Observatory starting up later this year, the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope, which should launch within the next couple of years. These are like the perfect platforms to make these kinds of discoveries of not just these planetary engulfment events, but a wide range of fields, subfields in astrophysics. So it's pretty exciting time for astronomy.
Well, here's hoping for more planetary deaths so you can all learn more about our cosmos. So Ryan, Colette, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much, Brendan.
That was Ryan Lowe and Colette Salig. Ryan is an astronomer at NSF's NOR Lab, and Colette is an associate professor of astronomy on the Maria Mitchell Chair at Vassar College. Still to come, one retired NASA astronaut's dream to encourage everyone to reach their highest potential.
Because I firmly believe that we are all born for a reason. We have certain tasks and things that we ought to do while we're here on this Earth.
That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. With new missions and technology that will come online, like SpaceX's Starship, and the possibilities surrounding AI technology, 2025 is a big year for space exploration. And under this new presidential administration, SpaceX could play a huge role in the growth of the space economy, but what role will economic uncertainty and tariffs play on the future? We'll look at the newest data from Space Capital from the Space IQ's quarterly report. That's next week on Are We There Yet? But for now, we are talking about the new book, Embracing Infinite Possibilities, Letting Go of Fear to Find Your Highest Potential. Its author, Dr. Bernard Harris, is a former NASA astronaut. He logged over 400 hours in space and is a veteran of 2 space flights, plus he was the first African-American to ever walk in space. After returning to Earth, Dr. Harris turned his passion for science and spaceflight into a passion for helping others. He is the author of Dreamwalker, A Journey of Achievement and Inspiration, and now his newest book is Embracing Infinite Possibilities, Letting Go of Fear to Find Your Highest Potential. He hopes to inspire others to be the best versions of themselves. Here to talk more about his career, his book, and his mission to help others is Dr. Bernard Harris. Dr. Harris, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we talk about this new book, I want to chat with you about your experience as an astronaut. And from the astronauts that we've had on this show before, we hear of the overview effect, right? You get a renowned sense of place and purpose on our planet back home. How did the overview effect affect you?
This is the first time I've heard it referred to as an overview, but I guess it really is. On my second mission, I got a chance to do a spacewalk. I donned this 350-pound spacesuit and walked outside, was out there for around 5 hours or so. But after we completed all of our activities, I got a chance to just take it all in. As you know, I think you've interviewed a number of us, that it really is a busy time on orbit, and we rarely get time where we can just sit back and take it all in. And so if you could imagine me on the end of a robotic arm, looking back at my crew members in the spaceship below me, and then the Earth, and then behind that, the Milky Way galaxy, it does give you a different perspective, sort of a God's eye view, as we say a lot. It does change your perspective on things. And for me, coming from my background, it also said, how can I share this perspective with others around me? And so that's probably the creation, the origin, in part, of some of the activities that I do around, community, giving back, and leadership.
I want to talk about that spacewalk because one of the chapters in your book is called Overcoming Fear and Taking the Leap. And when I've heard of recounts of spacewalks, to me, it is absolutely terrifying. how are you? You're putting your safety and your life in the hands of the engineers who designed your spacesuit, of your colleagues that are controlling the arm that's taking you to where you need to go, and you're zooming in orbit with just this protective suit to protect you from the vacuum of space. It sounds absolutely terrifying. Tell me a bit about how you overcame that.
If I can, I'll make it even more terrifying.
Oh, wonderful.
So, imagine that, you're on orbit 250 miles, nautical miles above the Earth, going around at 17,500 miles an hour, seeing a sunset or sunrise every 45 minutes, and you're just in microgravity. So you're just kind of floating there. I remember that first step was a doozy, because when we opened up the airlock door, it was pointed toward the Earth. So the first thing I had to overcome was this sense of falling. You ever remember walking up to a well? I grew up in the country, so we would go up to a well. I remember as a kid looking over the well, oh my God, it's deep. So that was the first sense. Yeah, and especially if you think about that, the airlock is about 3.5 to 4 feet in diameter. So it really is like a window to the world, but this world, we're moving by fairly quickly. So I had to overcome that first fear. The second was, once we got outside, there was this great sense of movement as we are moving across, just skirting across the atmosphere at 200 nautical miles. And there's this great sense of movement, and you couldn't stare at it too long because it would disorient you. Finally got what I call my space legs, or arms in this case, together, since we pull ourselves along using tethers. And I just focused on the activity, the satellite that we were about to handle, the activity that we had in preparation for building the International Space Station. And so it really is a good reference to, sometimes when we get into these situations, and they are scary, they are fearful, but what's important is that we then, if we choose to, can just focus on the task at hand, whatever that task is that you have to do. And put aside that fear, because if you keep that fear in it and it gets internalized, then it prevents you from really doing what you need to do.
And reading about that spacewalk, it was your job to retrieve a satellite that was in orbit. You literally had to grab a spacecraft that was orbiting at this immense speed and this immense altitude that you've already described there. I mean, that has got to be an inspiration, right?
For sure. Let me correct something a little bit. We certainly have grabbed grab satellites before when we needed to, but normally what we do is we grab it with the robotic arm. Going back to that picture, we're all floating at the rendezvous with the satellite. Then you use the robotic arm to actually reach out and slowly, as you catch up to the satellite, grab it. And so it really is this big choreography of activities that need to be done in order for us to grab a satellite and put it back in. So we normally don't grab it by hand. So I just want to make sure that's...
But close enough. I'm going to say that's close enough. So you're grabbing satellites out of space. You've made these trips to orbit. You've done a spacewalk, which very few people have gone to space. Even fewer people have done spacewalks. And that experience and your goal to instill inspiration in people down here on Earth, tell me who is this book written for?
As I started writing it, it really started out as me saying, okay, there are some concepts here that I think people need to grasp in order to be successful, whatever they decide to do. And I always like to say that I'm not here to recruit you to be an astronaut. I'm here to recruit you to be the best person that you can be. In that, you know, there are some tenets that I think are sort of consistent that people have to do in order to reach their full potential. In the book, I try to outline that in the different chapters, you know. So some of the chapters are titled, you know, Understanding Your Place in the World and Changing Your Perspective, you know, about the environment that you're in, Finding Your Calling. So these are just examples. And then raising your expectations, because some of us have low expectations of what we can do in life. And so I talk about all of those different things. So it can attract to different audiences, depending on where you are and who you are. So if you were to pin me down, it would be probably young adults, high school students, college students specifically, those people who are looking to literally reach their highest potential. Because I firmly believe that we are all born for a reason. We have certain tasks and things that we ought to do while we're here on this earth.
You alluded to this in your answer about the overview effect. I want to ask you about religion and faith. You mentioned it in the book. What role did it play in your time as an astronaut?
In those moments in which there may be opportunities where fear will raise its ugly head are the times in which I needed to rely on faith. I'll give you an example. I came in the astronaut class of 1990. When I came in, you know, we go through, you know, a year or two of basic training, then another 2 to 3 years of specific mission training. And I was pretty lucky. I was probably the first in my class to be selected for a mission. So this was 3 months after we had completed our astronaut candidate training. And then we were supposed to fly 8 months from the day in which I was asked to serve on this flight. 2 years later, we actually flew. And it was through a different, you know, many different stops and goes, meaning that we get assigned to a date that we're going to lift off, and then something happens. We had some fuel leaks in the whole space shuttle fleet, and then there were issues around some engines, and there were different issues. And finally, we think that we're going into space, get in the vehicle, we get down to the countdown, and main engines of the space shuttle light, and then a second and a half into that, we get master's alarms, and then the engines cut off. And talk about disappointed. At that point, you know, you begin to doubt, is this really going to happen? And I remember, you know, once we got out safely out of the vehicle and getting home and picking up the Bible, because I had been a believer for a long time, and picking up a passage that I talk about in the book that gave me solace. And that was, it talked about carrying me from the ends of the world and still holding me safely in God's arms. And that was just so comforting to me, enough to get me through the month of standing down until we got in the vehicle a month later and successfully launched in space. And now I got a chance because of, I think, in part, my faith, and of course, the training and all that sort of thing, but my faith primarily that allowed me to see the earth as I believe that God sees the earth.
What a poignant and relevant passage as a traveler in those sorts. That's very powerful. Thanks for sharing that. If you look at your bio, it's pretty incredible. Multiple degrees in science, medicine, business, space walker, two-time shuttle astronaut. But from what I've read about you, some of the most important work you do is with the Harris Foundation. Can you chat with me a bit about what that foundation does and how does that tie into kind of the message of your book?
We founded the foundation in 1998, but we've been doing the work probably starting 5 years before that. As an astronaut, as you can imagine, because of our experience, we get a chance to be asked at many different communities around the nation to come and talk to young folks, you know, whether they're in secondary education or in at the college level. And I realized as I was going across the country that there were issues in our education system. There were gaps, maybe said differently, in our education system that need to be filled. And sometimes, and it's not always, and so I don't want to, you know, I'm making this generality, but just to make the point that I saw that there was a need for people outside of the educational system that have experience outside the educational system, and people who had experiences that were different, like growing up in a modest community or growing up in a minority community or in the inner city or in the rural area, that needed to bring that perspective to students. And then secondarily, realizing that the world in which the students are going into were driven by education. So if you go to our website, theharrisinstitute.org, what you'll find is that our focus is on STEM education and STEAM education, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, with the A added for STEAM. And the focus is about preparing young people for the future, for the now, where technology drives everything that we do, and targeting all folks, but with a specific focus on socially and economically disadvantaged communities. So that's the focus. And then lastly, that we focus in three areas that are critical to, I believe, success, both individually and from a community standpoint, and that's through education, health, and wealth. So those are kind of the focuses.
Dr. Bernard Harris is a veteran NASA astronaut. His book is Embracing Infinite Possibilities. Dr. Harris, thanks for joining us.
Been a pleasure.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do it on the Central Florida Public Media app, the NPR app. You can get an Apple Podcast, Spotify, really wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with the show on social media. Our handles on Instagram and Facebook are at AWTY space. If you got an idea for a future episode or think you'd be a good guest, well, let us know. Our email is arewethereyet@cfpublic.org. We've got more space coverage online. Visit cfpublic.org/space. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Our intern is Allison Castillo. Editorial guidance from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.